In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. French secret agent Mathilde Carré led a life of truly heart-stopping peril, heroism, and compromise. She helped form the first great Allied intelligence network of the Second World War, before being betrayed and persuaded to work for the Germans. But did she truly ever abandon the Allied cause, or did she become a triple agent? Here in conversation with our production editor, Spencer Mizzen, Roland Phillips, who's just written a new book about Mathilde, answers these questions and explores the terrible moral dilemmas facing so many residents of wartime France.
Roland, your new book tells the remarkable tale of the Second World War spy Mathilde Carré, aka Victoire. Now, I wonder if you could start by telling me what drew you to this story. What is it about this woman that you find so compelling?
I was looking for a story. I was in conversation with a French person, very distinguished diplomat, and we were talking about the effects of the war in France. And he said, well, of course, your country and the Germans had it easy after the war because one of you was in the right and one of you was in the wrong. But we in France, everyone in France was horribly compromised. And that got me thinking, and I was looking for a subject who would embody the compromises necessary to survive in France. I've always been fascinated by double cross for the same sorts of reasons. So I was reading up about Operation Fortitude, our very successful double cross operation to persuade the Germans that the D-Day landings would happen elsewhere other than Normandy. And I was looking at Roman Chianowski's file, who was one of the key agents involved in that, Agent Brutus. And I came across this critique of a manuscript written by a colleague of his called Mathilde Carré. And I suddenly realized that, of course, being a woman in the war was even more complex than being a man. And so I started reading up about Mathilde Carré, and I realized she embodied the complexities of wartime morality through her story.
How does she get drawn into this world of espionage? Where did it all begin?
She had a very sort of disjointed childhood, was always longing to belong, and the outbreak of war was her moment. She became a nurse, very, very brave. She was one of only three of her intake of 80 nurses to remain a nurse during the catastrophic and very fast fall of France. She found herself sort of rather thrilling to danger. She was part of the Exodus. Her nursing station was in retreat. She was part of the Exodus by which millions of French people were heading south to safety. And at the fall of France, felt that her world was falling apart. Her marriage had ended. She'd had an affair with a soldier she was nursing and become pregnant by him. She then miscarried. She thought there was nothing left for her in the world. And she was in Toulouse and about to commit suicide. She was about to jump off a bridge into the river when she suddenly thought, she had a revival and thought, I will become a second Joan of Arc. I will sacrifice myself for France instead of to be useless. And two nights later, she was in a restaurant in Toulouse when her eye caught her. She quite often caught the eye of men, and her eye was caught by a small ball of energy who claimed his name was something other than his real name, which was Roman Chernowsky, who asked her to teach him French. They quite quickly became lovers. And after a while, he said to her, I plan to set up, he was a Pole, a very brave Polish soldier, airman, intelligence officer. And he said, I have a vision of a mighty network, which will cover the whole of occupied France, intelligence network, getting information out to the Allies. And I need a French person alongside me, and I would like that person to be you. So it was through her desire to do something for France and this strong emotional feeling that she had to die doing something useful that led her to set up the network that became Inter-Allié, which was in, this is November 1940, they started it up, which became, as our intelligence officers in this country said, our only reliable source of information about occupied France. You have to remember that there were no British soldiers in France. There's no British intelligence apparatus. We were absolutely locked up behind our cliffs awaiting invasion by the Germans. And we had no way of knowing what was going on in France, except when Inter-Allié started up.
Could you give us some examples of what this network did, what it achieved, how it took the war to the Germans?
What it did was they had cells of spies. They had about, I think, 15 or 16. They divided occupied France, northern France, into 16 or 17 areas. And they had cells of spies in each area who would take down the German order of battle. They would report back how many aeroplanes there were, how long they were flying for, so that, for example, during the Blitz, we could work out where the aeroplanes that were bombing Britain were coming from by dint of their flying time, and bomb the airfields. They were reporting from the docks on the ships in the docks so that we could bomb those, where the concentration of troops were, so we could, as we were planning to repel the invasion, we could know what quantities of troops were coming from where. And they reported on the armaments factories, what was being built, manufactured where, so to guide our bombing. Basically, they were reporting the whole order of battle, German order of battle in France.
And what made her so effective as a spy, as an agent?
She was completely fearless. She indeed took immense risks. She so reveled in her agent life that she took immense risks. She once went to Brest in Brittany to report on the accuracy of the British bombing so they could know whether they were on target or not, and was so sort of moved to see the spirit of the people of Brest that she started speaking in a British accent and was picked up by the Gestapo as a result when she got back to Paris, but managed to talk and charm her way out of that. And luckily she was picked up by a half-Irish Gestapo officer so they could reminisce, he felt divided and could reminisce about his mother and childhood. And it was really that, and high degree of organizational skill, because she had all these agents. She was the one who was going around the post boxes where the agents would leave their reports. She would collate all the material that then had to be got into as succinct a form as possible to be got to London. She was highly organized, very brave, and indefatigable. She so loved this, her life and being useful, that you just couldn't stop her. And there are reports of her scurrying around Paris in her. She always wore a red hat and a rather tatty black fur coat, and she would rush from post box to post box and agent to agent.
Did being a woman, did this make her job more difficult, or did it sometimes facilitate her work in any way? I mean, what impact did that have on the network?
I think that, well, it had two effects. First of all, I think it made her less noticeable. And actually, in early 1941, the Abwehr, the German intelligence, were not fully up to the speed they got to later, and weren't particularly looking for fifth columnists, and until indeed Andrew Allier was betrayed and they realized the scale of the fifth column operations. But it made some of the men, in particular the Frenchmen, so the network, because Roman was Polish, he brought along some of his Polish chums to be agents, but obviously the main agents all had to be French so as to be inconspicuous. Unfortunately, the Frenchmen were quite chauvinist, didn't like reporting to a woman, knew that the other head of the agency was a man, wanted to report to him, but of course for security reasons, Roman had to remain anonymous or pseudonymous, and he was called Armand or Valenti, and so that, in that way, she suffered. But I think it helped her remain undercover as regards the enemy.
So the first half of her story is extraordinary enough, but then this tale becomes even more complex, thorny, and heart-stopping when Victoire is betrayed to the Germans, and she now enters a real hall of mirrors. Can you describe how she was betrayed and what happened to her next?
The betrayal of Andrew Allier was purely by chance. It was huge by November 41, a year on. It's reckoned between 150 and 250 agents at any one time. And what happened, and again, perhaps this is peculiarly French, is that the head of the network in Brittany was a man, very ambitious man called Kiefer, who really wanted to be in head office. He didn't want to be running an area, a sector. And he had an affair with one of his sub-agents, a woman called Denise Bouffet. And so that was going on in the background. What really happened was that the Abwehr, German intelligence, were getting a lot of teasing, no more than that, really, for being so ineffective, not uncovering any of these spies that the Germans had to believe were operating. And one day, one of the sub agents in this Brittany sector got very drunk and was sitting in a bar with a Luftwaffe officer and started asking him questions about how many planes he had, how many, how often they had to refuel, all the questions he'd been trained to ask. And the Luftwaffe officer passed this on to the local Abwehr man, who normally wouldn't have thought too much about it, would have just thought this is a drunken Frenchman gossiping away. But when he reported that to Paris, where, because they were under pressure to catch some spies, they thought, well, we better send someone out to investigate this. They sent a man from Paris who stopped off in Cherbourg to ask for an interpreter because he didn't speak very good French. And there was this junior policeman called Hugo Bleicher who said, I'll be your interpreter. And in talking to this drunken docker, he revealed that he reported back to Denise Bouffet. They went to her house, and in her house they found, unfortunately, she'd broken all tradecraft rules and kept a list of agents, amongst which was Kiefer. So Bleicher and his Abwehr boss simply waited at Cherbourg station for the next time Kiefer came for a debrief and arrested him. And Kiefer told all. And that was the beginning of the betrayal. The Germans had no idea at all of the scale of Interallier. They then went to Paris and thought that they would find someone, you know, who was taking low-level information from Cherbourg. But in fact, when they Kiefer led them not to Roman and Mathilde, but to an underling, a Pole, who was tricked into telling them where the headquarters was. And Roman and his girlfriend, who also worked in the agency, were arrested at dawn the following day. And the girlfriend gave away Mathilde. The Germans still had no idea of the scale of the operation. And the following morning, she was walking to work in the fog in Montmartre when she too was arrested. And from there, the cascade of betrayal of the agents happened, because of course she was the person who was the fulcrum for the whole network, organize the agent meetings and so on. And they knew exactly from her when the agent sector heads were next due to meet. The really shocking part of her arrest is that Hugo Bleicher, but this policeman translator, was by this time put in charge of the whole operation, and he became a very notable spy hunter throughout the war. And he took her back to the headquarters of the Abwehr and seduced her that first night. He absolutely, which broke her spirit. I mean, she felt she had to submit to this. She was completely numb, in shock, submitted to this. And from then on, she was a broken figure who, although she did her best to cover up, he had all the documentation and was able to round up large numbers of agents. At the same time as pretending, as seizing the wireless, the network transmitter, to keep the network going as far as the British were concerned. So he turned her and then turned the whole network.
So what happened next? I mean, what kind of damage did she, in effect, wreak to the Allied cause while she was working for the Germans?
Well, she was really a prisoner of the Germans. She was not an unwilling prisoner in that she realized that if she didn't go along with them, she'd be killed. They told her she'd be killed. So she had turned. She hated the life. She hated living with these Germans in the villa they commandeered. A Roman's girlfriend was there too. They loathed each other. So she was the only other Frenchman. Her life was spent initially for the first week after her capture, going around fulfilling her meetings that they knew she was going to have from her diary. And each time she had one, Bleicher would be behind with a lorry load of Gestapo men to round up the agents. Interestingly, quite a few of them, and this is where what I mean about the sort of whole business of France in the war and why it's not right that we make immediate moral judgments, working for the Germans bad, working for the Allies good, because they were offered death or imprisonment or both, perhaps, or turning. And some of the agents after the war, when they were tried, said, I had to get out of prison because I was looking after my elderly parents. And they would have starved to death without me. So they were taking these decisions. So a number of them agreed to be turned. But what Mathilde did was pretended that she was still at large and transmitting, which enabled the Germans to put out a lot of false information over her radio. That was the worst damage.
Do you think always, though, at heart, her sympathies lay with the Allied cause, even when this was going on?
I do. And indeed, when she had a chance to get back to the Allied cause, she seized it with both hands. And I think she felt brutalized by her relationship with Bleicher and by the coarseness of the Germans. And she always remembered the excitement of those early days of working against the invaders of her country. And this was not what she wanted at all, to be working alongside them. So I think she was determined to find her way, which she started to do after about 6 weeks.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
We were astonished to find, alongside our hero, de Vomcourt, to find this rather bedraggled French woman who'd been working for the Abwehr all along, and we just couldn't work it out what was going on.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So how did that happen? Am I right in saying that she ended up escaping the clutches of the Germans and coming to Britain? Is that correct?
She did. It was the most extraordinary turn of events in that, as I said earlier, the Interallié radio was really one of the very few points of contact between the Allies and London. And when we had the idea of starting SOE, we sent back quite early on a French soldier who'd escaped just after Dunkirk called Pierre de Vomecourt, who was an early SOE officer. And he was sent to France to get a band of resistors together, in effect. And he was his own network called Autogiro had 10,000 members. We reckoned in SOE here that he had 25,000 followers at his disposal. So this was the beginning of SOE in France. Extraordinary, vital that we got it going. And in turn, it became vital that Pierre de Vomecourt had an outlet to get messages back to London. And so we told him that the Interallié radio had been saved by Mathilde Carré and that he should meet her and use her as his transmitter. So he, through an intermediary, had a meeting with her, and Bleicher, on behalf of the Abwehr, couldn't believe his luck when he heard that that this new resistance organization was now about to fall into his hands. He'd already taken over the biggest intelligence network. So he said, play along with this. So she had meetings with de Vomecourt. They were very taken with each other. And she began to see him as her way out, but had to obviously keep keep playing along with Bleicher. And the chance that turned the whole thing around, really, was that she'd been told that she had to provide him with anything he wanted, and he needed fake identity cards for his people. And so she produced a lot of these, and the Germans produced a lot of these. And when, as soon as he saw them, de Vomcourt thought, this is a bit odd. These look really good. They're not the smudgy things, forgeries that we're used to. And indeed, they were really good because they were official papers. And then he began to think, well, hang on, there's one or two other things I've been trying to investigate. This on behalf of the resistance, and I found it blocked by German soldiers. So how did they know about that? And the penny suddenly dropped, and he said, you're working for the Germans, aren't you?
So he confronted her, basically.
So he confronted her, and he had to make a split-second decision, as he said afterwards. He could have killed her there and then, but then it would have been all up with him, and these huge, and he was too important to betray him. Or he could try and get her on side. His great gamble was to say, I know you're working for them, and you've got to work for me. And she immediately said, I've only ever wanted to work for the Allies. Of course I'll work for you. And in fact, that same day they started sleeping together. And that was the beginning of her turning. Of course, he then had to decide, was she for real, was she for not? The thing that everyone had to decide about her in the war. He consulted with his lieutenant, who was an Englishman, remarkable man called Ben Cowburn, and another colleague of his, and they decided this was all they could do was hope she was trustworthy, because if they would, or they could try and disappear themselves that same day, but then they wouldn't have done their job. And so that was his great gamble. And her brilliance, because she was a very emotional, she didn't hide her emotions, but she managed for the next 2 months to persuade Bleicher that she was still working for him, whilst in fact she was making plans with de Vomcourt to escape to Britain. It was essential he got back to Britain for debriefing, money, all sorts of reasons. So he had to place, de Vomcourt had to place his trust in her while she had to maintain Bleicher's trust. So she was a double agent twice.
It's extraordinary. I mean, how did they get her out of the country in the end?
They sent a message. So obviously, because the Germans were watching the messages, they couldn't say, they could never say that she'd been turned back to de Vomcourt. So they made plans to get him out of the country with German connivance, and she then planted in the German mind that if she went with him, not only could she keep an eye on him, but there she'd be in the heart of the Allied intelligence and military networks, so she could report back from there, and that they'd only be gone 2 weeks. And Bleicher, who was quite naive, he hadn't been trained in intelligence, absolutely loved this idea, got permission from Berlin. He even suggested at one point she write a book while she was there called 15 Days in London. And he gave her a list of questions to ask. And so they began to plan. So they sent a message openly to London saying, please send a boat to get us out of here. But of course, what they couldn't say was that she would be going too, because they'd smell a rat. So they simply said, so send a boat with enough room for two. Don't ask any questions, in effect, they said. And eventually, because they had a couple of false starts, one where they nearly all drowned in the sea in February, eventually she arrived in London on a March day in 1942. And we were astonished to find, alongside our hero, de Vomcourt, to find this rather bedraggled French woman who'd been working for the Abwehr all along, and we just couldn't work it out what was going on.
So what kind of reception did the British authorities give her?
Very puzzled we were. De Vomcourt was going to, and by this time they were lovers, and he was going to be put in a house on the edge of Kensington Gardens, a flat, which they then had to delay. As soon as she arrived, they sent a message from Portsmouth saying, they can't move in yet, we better get a load of bugs in. So they bugged the walls and the telephones, which was fantastic for my research because I had all the conversations. And then they had to work out whether she was for real, whether she was still working for the Germans, whether de Vomcourt himself had been turned. So they had this huge jigsaw, endless debriefings of both them separately and together. They made her tell her story several different times to try and see if there were inconsistencies in it. Again, marvellous for my research that all these papers were written down. And at the same time, they couldn't separate her from de Vomcourt because he was by this time quite in love with her and kept saying, I'm not going back unless she comes with me. And they thought, we can't let her go back. So MI5, MI6 and SOE were all debating this endlessly. SOE were determined she shouldn't go back because they were worried she knew too much about their operations. MI6 thought, well, it could be quite useful to send her back if she's really working for us. So there were internal circularities as they thrashed this out over weeks and weeks. And I think Anthony Eden, who was Foreign Secretary, was very keen de Vomcourt should meet Winston Churchill, who loved the whole notion of SOE, but then decided maybe it wouldn't be politic. And I suspect that was because of his involvement with Mathilde, who they simply didn't understand. So it was a very complex, confusing time, she was half quite upset at not being trusted, and half she was loving because we wanted to keep her on side. We gave her a very generous expense allowance, and she loved going around London and dining in the smart restaurants and going to what nightclubs there were and so on. So it was a strange time for her, not entirely unpleasurable, but she was feeling that now she'd started back on her road to heroism, she wasn't being given full rein.
So what happened towards the end of the war and after the war to Mathilde?
So eventually we did separate her from de Vomcourt. He realised his duty was to go back. So he was parachuted back. Meanwhile, we were putting out information on the wireless, on the transmitter, to say that they were both still in London to give him time to do his work, but he was quite soon captured. And at which point the Germans got very puzzled as to whether she was betraying them or had been betrayed. De Vomcourt gave nothing away. He was tried and sent to Colditz. We didn't know that he'd been captured, except we didn't hear from him, so we assumed the worst. And at that point, or after a few weeks, we realised that sending out these messages pretending he was still in London were useless. So we sent out a few sort of feeler messages to work out whether they knew what we knew and so on. And in the end decided they had to shut the wireless down. So we did that and then had a real dilemma what to do with her. We couldn't give her the free French because she'd worked for the Germans and they would possibly kill her. They would certainly hate her. We couldn't send her back because she knew too much. Simply couldn't work out what to do with her. So in the end, he took the very tough decision to intern her in late 1942. We interned her in Aylesbury and then Holloway prisons. And she felt bitterly betrayed. She had, after all, enabled the lead man of the resistance to come to this country and escape arrest, and could be said to have helped the resistance come into being. And yet here she was locked up with a lot of pro-German spies and who hated her. And it was a very bitter 3 years. She wrote, she offered to become a nurse. She offered to go to North Africa and work for the British there, but we simply couldn't allow her out. And her MI5 case officer, it was a remarkable man called Christopher Harmer, felt really bad and went to see her a lot, wrote to her a lot, as long as he was in London. And that was her only real human contact.
And I guess for somebody who's used to living such a high-octane life full of thrills and spills, but being locked up essentially for 3 years, that must have made it even more hard to deal with.
Very, very hard. She became, I think she was a difficult prisoner for sure. She became very depressed. She became very ill, in fact. And the French, meantime, after the liberation in August 44, were very keen to put their house back in order, their moral house back in order, and started demanding her back, which we couldn't send her back, because by this time Roman Chianowski had talked his way out of prison to come and work for us, though the Germans thought he was working for them, as I said at the beginning, as Agent Brutus and Operation Fortitude. And should she have gone back and spilt the beans about him, that might have been very bad news for Operation Fortitude. So even for the last few months of the war, the French kept demanding her back because they wanted to try her, put her, their house in order. The so-called purge trials had started up immediately in 1944. And we didn't let her go. But as soon as the war ended, she was back to France and then incarcerated for the next 4 years before she came to trial.
When you were writing this book, did you find that you warmed to her as a person? I mean, did you feel sympathy with what she went through?
I think I admired her spirit, her courage, and I felt sorry for the way she was treated. Yes, she had indeed worked for the Germans, but at the same time, she'd been extraordinarily brave on our behalf, provided us not only with a lot of very valuable information, but also, as I was saying, saved Pierre de Vomecourt and enabled him to set up the resistance. So I felt she was badly treated. I understand why she was treated the way she was, because she'd worked for Germans. But I did feel a sympathy for her and admiration for her courage and her attempts to do the right thing in very hard circumstances. I mean, if you were arrested, told you'd be killed unless you gave out information and worked for the enemy, what would you do?
And what does this story tell you about the world of espionage in the Second World War? I mean, it seems like I mentioned before, it was a real hall of mirrors and people were required to make excruciatingly difficult judgments. It was never black or white. I mean, is that something you really took out of your research for the book?
Yes, that what I really took from is that in the world of espionage, survival also becomes an important factor. And there's a question of to how far patriotism, ideology can carry you if your life is threatened. And if people become spies for patriotic motives, which I imagine an awful lot of them do, how far can that take you if your life is in danger. And also in how much personalities come into play, even sort of when they're clear-cut goals, such as being allied or Nazi, how much personalities affect judgments others are making of you as a spy.
How is Mathilde remembered in France today? I mean, is her name well known?
Her name isn't well known. She was tried. She was one of tens of thousands of people tried after the war in 1949. And her trial in itself was I feel all the trials were, with hindsight, sort of not exactly compromised, but morally complex, in that people had to be tried for their behavior in the war, of course, but the juries, by force of logic, had to be made up of resistance, proper patriotic resistance people. So there were very few fair trials. And in her case, I think it was possibly an unfair trial. It wasn't an unfair trial because she was tried on her two-month period of working for the Germans, which she couldn't, there was ample evidence of, she couldn't deny. They had her diaries. They knew she'd slept with Bleicher, which was possibly the worst crime, her worst crime in the eyes of the jury. But they couldn't take into account the good things she did, both before and after that. So she was sentenced to death on those grounds, that she had carried out intelligence with the enemy was the charge, which was undeniable. And she was, just before her sentence was carried out, so we're now in late 1949, when the appetite for judicial killing had somewhat passed. Her lawyer, who himself a resistance hero, wrote a very compelling argument that her life should be spared, and it was. And after that, she basically retreated from life. She, while in prison, she got very, very religious and channeled all this intense emotional energy of hers into religion. She withdrew from social life and really became a hermit. And in fact, it wasn't known whether it was widely thought she died in 1970. But in fact, I found her death certificate that showed she, in fact, died in 2010. So much had she withdrawn. She did write a book in the 50s, slightly rather self-justifyingly, about her wartime exploits, which was published. There was an immensely wonky film made called La Chatte, which was one of her code names, where not based on her, but taking her name, where this woman who works for the Germans acts like a sort of James Bond figure and starts shooting Germans up, all things she didn't do. So that she is known about, but she really faded from memory.
That was Roland Phillips. His book, Victoire, A Wartime Story of Resistance, Collaboration and Betrayal, is out now, published by Vintage. You can find a link in the episode description. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tomorrow, Alex von Tunzelmann will be explaining everything you need to know about the Suez Crisis.